So in some feeble attempt to stay on track and on time here, I guess we're going to get started. So this is not a bait and switch, but we're going to start with something that's not quite the topic that we talked about for the morning. Every 8 months, once a year, something like that, I do what I call the talk. So if you're a dad, you think the talk is when you sit your nine-year-old down and explain to him that kids don't come from storks and all that, but that's not the talk that we do here. The talk that we do here is, what is men's ministry and why do we do it? And how might you want to become involved? And what is it that we're hoping happens in your life? So a few critical questions. All right. So what is men's ministry? It is the process of building into you spiritual fitness. So if you've been here for any length of time, you've undoubtedly heard that phrase used and heard it described. What is spiritual fitness?
The term fitness itself.
Okay. Jimmy used a phrase that I don't like to use, contrasted with the phrase that I do like to use. The phrase that I don't like to use is spiritual maturity, because we've all heard that phrase, we think we understand what it means, and it just sounds like a process of getting smarter and older. Spiritual fitness is a little bit different, although it embraces all of the same concepts if spiritual maturity is understood correctly. Spiritual fitness is my inner man's ability to respond well to all the circumstances that come into that person's life. Okay, so here is a list of the things that we would say constitute spiritual fitness. Effectively meet the demands of everyday life successfully. Do you feel like life won at all this week? Like if there was a scoreboard up there, who won for the week? Was it life or you? Okay, well, you think about that. I don't see any.
Well, I think every man at some point in their week, he says, man, I love it. That was good. That was good. Or can say, man, that was cool, awesome, I love it. That was, I often, you know, use the word before, I still think we all have an inventory.
Okay. Now, I'm not talking about the externals. Did I land the sale? Did I get the contract signed? Did I get along with my wife? I mean, some of those are external, some are internals. When you look back on your performance throughout the week, your attitudes throughout the week, would you say that you won this week or didn't win? And I know winning versus losing is maybe not the way you describe it, but it's a different way to look at it. All right. Recognize and live into the opportunities that were there in your life. That's it. That's a whole different measure. It's not, did you succeed at what you were already thinking about, but did you let great opportunities slip away that were right there? Did you even recognize the opportunity? Because that's a form of spiritual fitness. Avoid distractions which lead to disappointments. Did you start out the week intentionally deciding, I'm going to live according to this or according to that, but sometime during the week, something got your interest, something got your attention, and moved you off center and off of what you said you were living for? Do you ever get spiritually distracted? In other words, this is the purpose that I'm living my life toward. These are the big things that I'm living toward. And yet something else sort of got my attention and diverted me. And now I went off on this tangent. Now that's okay. That happens to all of us. The measure of spiritual fitness is not that it never happens. It's how soon you recognize what a distraction is and say, oh, that's a distraction, I need to get back on track. So if it's 2 months until you recognize that you've been distracted, then maybe there's a little bit of spiritual work to do. If it's 2 hours before you say, you know what, I'm not sure that that's what I need to be doing, then you've improved in your day-to-day spiritual fitness. All right, so we've looked at distractions. Distractions are not necessarily bad. They're just not the life that you are to live now versus temptations. Was there some temptation that overcame you this week in a big way? And incidentally, temptations change over time. So when we think temptations, we usually think, did I lust? Did I flip out? And was I in a fit of rage this week or whatever? And I'm not saying, look, that's if that's where you are right now, okay, then you maybe succumb to temptation. But as you move into new seasons of life and as you take on new opportunities, different types of temptation take place. So for instance, a ministry leader is facing temptations at a different level maybe than somebody else. You, as you mature in things, are going to face a different level of temptation. Can anybody think, let's say, of a temptation that you might not have had 5 years ago when you were less spiritually fit? Today you find that you are tempted in that way. Okay, if you thought you couldn't do anything right, the temptation is to beat yourself up. But suppose you start to achieve success. What's the new temptation that wasn't a temptation before but now is as the result of growth?
Well, the temptation is to believe that it's my doing this now. You know, who is the Lord? Oh, man, this ministry is going so great, it must be me. You know, my job is going so great for the past couple of weeks, it must be me. So I start to take on the I, look what I did. Well, I've lived that for a minute. Let me tell you, after 2 weeks of I, God said, okay, humble and humiliated, if you get the pick, let me tell you, the humiliation was absolutely unbelievable, because for the next 2 weeks, everything I touched is kind of crap. So I think that you can get to a point where temptations believe that, oh, it is me.
Or, when you're new at something, don't you try very hard? But if you've been doing it and achieved some level of success for a while, do you start to think, I got this. I used to pour 8 hours of energy a week into doing this, and now I'm only putting 2 hours because I got this. It's no problem. You see, in each new season, if you think of temptation as these isolated collection of behaviors that you might fall prey to, not as something that you will face for the rest of your life, just in different ways and different forms, and if you're not fit enough to recognize it, well, then you're going to fall prey to new things. Okay, and here's the final one. Are you experiencing joy in human relationships and in your relationship with God? So that's another measure of things. In other words, do you like you in a good way? Are you experiencing the benefit and the blessing of other relationships? And are you experiencing satisfaction in your relationship with God? All those are measures of spiritual fitness. All right, any questions before we move on? Let me insert this. I know you're thinking, what in the world does this have to do with the series that we're starting today? And you're going to see a little bit of connection as we move on, if you haven't already. All right, so how do we do this? What's my role? What's a ministry role? How is this accomplished? Well, there's several things that we do. So the first is what we're doing right here. It's just provide teaching / training. In other words, you don't know that you don't know, and we have to help you to know that there are these things that you might know. So we're going to look at it in terms of either a team sport or an individual sport. Team sports players spend time studying the game. Right? They need to know the plays, they need to know the theory, they need to, if they're playing tennis or whatever it is, they need to know what happens on a cold day, what happens on a windy day. It's more than just know the plays, it's know the other teams. There's a lot of intellectual content that goes into being a good competitive athlete. Would you agree? All right. But there's more than that to it. So this is the educational component of it. That's part of what we do here. But another part of it is a great athlete is also physically conditioned. So one of my jobs, hopefully Jim does this same thing, is to teach people how to train themselves during the week. So for instance, is a football player a great football player who knows theory well but couldn't lift 20 pounds? Is a football player great who knows theory well but is exhausted at the end of the first quarter?
He's a coach.
Well, yes, he used to be a player and now he's a coach. Do you find yourself spiritually depleted and exhausted because you're not up to the day-to-day challenges of your life? So it's not enough to know theory. And here's where this all breaks down. There's a lot of people that believe that spiritual fitness, we'll say, is about knowing a lot of stuff. The real measure is whether you can use the stuff. So the guy who knows football theory or knows tennis or knows boxing or whatever, he knows how to do the job, he simply can't do it, is still not spiritually fit. All right, so now we move into the next thing. And incidentally, my job is to help you to understand how to train personally. My job isn't to train for you. So maybe a question that you want to ask yourself is, are you satisfied with your personal training program that occurs 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 days a week? And do you know what you're doing, or does it just happen randomly and by accident if you're lucky enough to squeeze it in? All right, next thing. Every team practices. So it's not enough to know the theory. It's not enough to be physically fit. The team needs to get together and they need to work on the skills that they're learning and the strength that they've acquired. Do we have ways that we're practicing spiritual fitness? And again, ministry, an organized ministry, can provide some structure for that. We can do some things together. We can set up some things, and we're really weak at this, I have to tell you. We're really weak at organizing practice events. The kinds of things that get us together and help us to say, okay, this is what we're going to do. I know you're great at this, you're great at this, you're great at that, and we're going to come together and we're all going to do this together. We need to work on that. There's a great opportunity, even within this group, for some work on that. Where's the real game played, though? And this is where it all breaks down again for a lot of men who think that spiritual fitness is knowledge, or spiritual fitness is secondarily, it's what I do in church. Where's the real game of life played in your life? At home, at work, the other opportunities you have. And so the real measure of your spiritual fitness is, does the world that you live in, I mean your personally crafted and shaped world, does that look any different than it used to? Do your relationships feel different, look different somehow? Does your workplace, as a result of your being there, look and feel different, and hopefully in a good way? As you look back on the last 3 or 4 years of your life, can you say, you know, 3 years ago I would have been at home in front of the television right now. Today I'm out doing this or that that's actually making a difference in somebody else's life. Now those are just arbitrary measures. I'm not telling you what the measure of your personal spiritual fitness is and what you're doing. But do you have a system that you're using to measure it? And if you don't, then that's something that you need to consider. All right, so my job then, Jim's job, the job of anybody else, Vinny's job, is to simply help us, to bring us along in that process. But at some point in time, every coach moves from telling the team how to play to essentially, and we've all watched this if in no other place, in a movie, where there's the big game and the coach, right before the second half starts, says, you know, this is your time, but only if you want it. The question is, do you really want to win? The question is, do you really want to be spiritually fit? And so that's the invitation here. Do you want to step up and step into some things? And do you want to, A, care for yourselves? That's part of the team mentality, that we're responsible to each other. We're not just responsible to ourselves. And do we want our lives to count for something more? All right, that is the talk in brief. I'm sorry I didn't answer the question about where babies come from, but maybe we'll have that in another week. Anybody have any questions or comments? Jim, I'm sure you're bubbling.
I'm letting you get
through. Okay.
I would just like to say one thing about you said about temptation, and I think that as you grow spiritually, I don't know that it's all just by accident those other temptations come along, because I think Satan loves a mediocre Christian, one who just stagnates and say, okay, you know, I accept Christ, but I'm not going to do anything else to promote Christ's cause. I think that you have a target on your back as you move forward.
Okay.
Well, that's part of your the only thing that I was thinking about is, you know, if you're a good player, it's easy to just work on yourself, but the best thing you can do is get the other team's tape and watch what they do, watch how they play. That guy always hits his left, that guy always leaves a hole open, that guy always does this, that guy always does that. You know the other team. You know what he's going to do before he does it. Because they're watching you. They're watching your tapes. So sometimes, you know what I mean? And spiritually, you got to switch it up. If you're just used to, let's just say you're just used to sitting down in the morning, reading scripture. That's what you do. You sit down and go 5, 10, 20, 2 hours of scripture. You use 4 for the scripture. That's great. You already know it by heart. Maybe pick up a book that somebody else wrote and said, hey, have you ever thought about this? Have you ever thought about making that play look like this? Have you ever thought about opening that up in this position? Have you ever thought about putting that person over here? I think that there's ways that we can get stuck. You know what I mean? As a team can, they can get stuck. Well, we only have these 10 plays, these 30 plays, these are all the plays we have. And you have to throw in a trick play once in a while to confuse the other team. So sometimes we have to put this away, pick up something that we can pour through that talks about us, that we can relate to sort of change up our mind, like our mindset. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say complacent, but we sort of stay focused on the same thing over and over and over. I mean, boring. Because I can tell you, this can be boring. So I need to look at something else that asks different questions, that asks different questions of me, makes me think, oh, wait a minute, maybe that is me. And then I can grow like my spiritual strength. It's that muscle confusion thing. It's P90X, you know? You don't work out the same way every day. You have to confuse your muscles so that they... I think spiritually we can do that too. Oftentimes we just get stuck in, this is what we do, and become these little spiritual robots. No. Mix it up. Why? Because he is. The enemy's mixing it up. He's doing everything he can at you from every interaction.
All right. So, got it. One final thought then. Define a win. Because we've talked about this in competitive terms, but we're not really competing against each other. We're not competing against the church down the road or whatever it is that we think we're competing against. We're not competing against culture and all these other things. Okay, we tend to brand things so that we can find a victory. Do we know how God would define victories in each of our lives? It's an important question. Not how God would necessarily define victory for all of us, because we all have these, what I'm going to call, standard packaged cliche type answers. How would God define spiritual victory for you for this month? It's a question worth asking and then meditating on, and then actually maybe even writing down a few thoughts that come to mind. I never use the J word, journal, or anything like that, because it sounds so unmasculine. But I mean, if you were to have a book where you kept those ideas, and you were to just call it a notebook or something.
When you get old,
Jim, it's too late. If you're lecturing me about that, it's too late.
When you get old, you say you don't like the journal. When you get old, and you take all of your thoughts that you've ever written down, all those things you've ever written down, you put them in a book. What do they call them?
A memoir.
Your memoirs.
Okay.
So don't call it that. Make a book of memoirs. Make a book of
Facebook. That's what you call Dear Diary.
In the end, you're going to be able to look back at anything, or you're just going to drift on into the next life, not knowing anything that you did, not knowing anything that God did in your life. There's no altars built to God. There's no place you can go, man, I remember when God showed up. In the desert of your life, when you're starting to get some dementia, if you have a notebook, we all remember the movie, a notebook that you can look at and go, oh, yeah, you know what? I remember when God showed up here. I remember that kid's name. I wrote it down. I remember his name.
Mm-hmm.
He stayed in my house. He became a Marine. Couldn't put the drugs down. I wish I had done a better job. I wish I had called him more, because the OD could borrow. And done. But I can still see his face. I still remember his name. I wrote it down.
And I even think, and we do have to move on, because I know some of you are not here for the bait and switch topic, you're here for the real topic, but just what Jim said, does a past, we'll call it a loss or a setback, does a past setback make you feel that you're now disqualified for a present or a future opportunity? I'm not the right person for this new opportunity because I failed at that previous opportunity. And what would we call that in light of what we've already talked about? That's either a temptation to quit or a distraction to do something easier. So a past failure does not disqualify us automatically from a future opportunity. And sometimes we feel that. As a matter of fact, if I want anybody to be taking advantage of the new opportunity, it might be somebody who failed in the past and understands why they failed, rather than somebody who's never had failures and thinks that they've got it all figured out. Okay, so if nobody talks now, we can move on to the next thing. All right. For the sake of some of you who are here because you thought I was going to give you a three-step process that was going to help you to decide in all the times when you got into a jam in your life, this is not that series. So I am not going to be telling you step by step, point by point, what decisions you should make. Instead, my objective here is to help you to understand yourself, understand your life, understand your opportunities, and take responsibility for the decisions that you have to make. So now we can have a little bit of interaction here. Show of hands. How many of you have delayed on a big decision that you had to make because you just wanted more information, more time, more certainty? What do we call that? Well, yes, we do call that procrastination.
That's what my wife calls it.
Well, hold on. Now, when you say it's taking more time, I'm the guy who possibly runs into on lazy.
That's my wife.
And,
literally.
And can cause collateral damage.
Okay.
So,
Paul, are you on your way to get coffee?
What's that?
So, I can run into lazy and cause collateral damage. One of the guys, Harley Davidson, whom came from that shop yesterday, and said, "Hey, are we okay?" He said, "Yeah, we're okay. We're just collateral damage." And the first thing that I recognized when I sent that email, I was hot. And so I can do that. What I've learned to do is, Barb, read this.
Mm-hmm.
Before I send it, read it.
Okay. And what would we call that? A form of managing the inner man. My spirit man. And so you have become more spiritually mature as a result of a past failure, right? Doesn't mean you're not going to fail at some point in the future.
My wife didn't want me to go to jail last week when my neighbor shot the window out of my car. So he's still alive, living three doors down. Because I did kick the door in between the light. She said, "Maybe wait. Just wait."
Maybe wait? Smart woman there. Maybe wait.
So,
kill that dude tomorrow, not today. All right, now, I'm actually going to try to take Jim's, whatever that was, monologue, rant, something. I'm going to take that and I'm going to try to spin it a little bit, okay? Because it actually sets us up for a good real-life situation. What did Jim say? He has a situation and he doesn't know quite yet how to respond to the situation. So what's he doing? He's putting more space in there. He's putting a little bit of margin while he tries to calculate a better choice. That's exactly the same question I just asked. So, have you ever been in a situation where you needed more time, more thought, more information, more something? What do we call that? So, Paul said we call it procrastination, which is true at times. At other times, we call that a choice all by itself. The choice not to choose is a choice all by itself. So let's not fool ourselves. When today you say, "I'm not sure," and don't do anything, that was a choice. All right. Now, how many of you have ever felt guilty about the fact that you thought you should make a choice? You wanted to choose, and you sat there and you languished, and maybe there were other people that were putting pressure on you. There's external pressure. You need to make up your mind. You need to choose. Are we going here or are we going there? Are we doing this or are we buying this or are we buying that? Or are we not buying anything? Have you ever felt external pressure to make a choice? Okay. So I thought this list here that I took from a book, it's called Better Than Before, by Gretchen Rubin. It's a book on habits, and what she has noticed, she spent a number of years studying people, studying habit, and one day she describes this situation. She had been talking with a friend, and the friend was having a difficult time getting into a workout routine as an adult. And I know this sounds like a silly example, but just work with it. All right. And so Gretchen says, and I don't understand this. And I talk to my friend, and she doesn't understand it. She used to run track in high school and in college. She trained faithfully every day. And yet here's this woman who is struggling to go out for a several mile run every day as an adult. And it's not as if she doesn't have the time. She just doesn't do it. And so that was the springboard for her to start to explore. Are there differences in the way that people look at life and understand the responsibilities? So we're going to look at the four types of people that she divides us up into. You don't need to use her words, but I think it creates a benchmark by which we can look at ourselves. Upholders, she said, respond readily to both outer expectations and inner expectations. Forgive the typos there. In other words, if your wife wants you to do something, you'll say sure. If the church expects you to do something, you want to comply, you want to fit in. But also, if you have some internal guidance system that says, I should do this, you're the kind that wants to meet expectations. So wherever you go, your mission in life is essentially to make people happy who are expecting things of you. Next category, she says, after looking at people, she says, are questioners. They just look at everybody's expectations and say, I'm not sure about that. My own expectations, your expectations for me, why should we do that? Can you give me a good reason? So we'll take it back to the simple example of the woman who needs to get out and develop an adult fitness plan. And every morning she would wake up and say, well, why should I go run today? Do I have a new reason to run today? Now think about this. Do you have any personal disciplines that you ask yourself every new day? Should I do this today? Do I feel like doing this today? And if you're in the right mood, you do. And if you're not in the right mood, you don't. The next category, and this is what Gretchen ultimately discovered that her friend fell into, were obligers. They respond readily to external expectations. So if somebody else is pressuring you to make a decision, you'll make the decision. But if the decision and the consequences of the decision are all internal, in other words, you're the one that has to decide and you're the one that will reap the benefits or the consequences if they're negative, there's no external pressure on you at all. And therefore, you don't oblige because you're committed to reaching other people's expectations maybe, but you have no expectations for yourself. And finally, the last category of people are rebels who just resist everybody's expectations. They don't just question them. They just say, no, I don't think I'm going to do that today. So if you had to categorize yourself in one or perhaps two of these, which would it be? You got a lock on that? All right. Why does that matter? I believe it matters for this reason. Whose expectations are you feeling guilty about not meeting when you don't decide something? Remember the title of the series, What to Do When You Don't Know What to Do? Here's the question. Why should you know what to do, and why do you have to do anything? I know that was complicated, so let me back up and say that again. Why should you know what to do, and why do you have to do anything? Where does that expectation come from? Is it something imposed on you from outside? Is it something that's been, we'll say, coded into you by relationships that you've had in the past? Parental expectations, educational expectations, friend expectations, the crowd you run with, whatever it is. What is calling on you to make this choice?
I think the examples we see in Hebrews 11:1 goes on the list, by faith so-and-so did something. Off with the stories of people who did something. You can't think of a single story where the story was that he sat on his butt or he didn't make a decision. There are examples over and over again in the Bible. Like Abraham didn't know where he was going but heard God's voice and went. Ended up in the wilderness for years but followed God. And Moses, same thing. I don't know where we're going. It's a chosen land. Let's go. Lead over a million people into the wilderness and then get stuck there for 40 years. Still probably.
But there's
Do you feel a good movie line coming? I feel like there's the start of a script for a great movie.
Like Paul said earlier, you know, my dad used to say, he was a great military man. He used to say, do something even if it's wrong. We'll fix it later. But don't do nothing. The last one.
I can see Paul doing that.
But, Paul, you know those guys too. You're
yeah, my father was that way too.
But you're a doctor. You know the guy who waits too long. He just waits and waits and waits. And now it's, I'm sorry, sir. You have that conversation. When you come talk to me for your wife, you have that conversation. Why? Because he didn't do, he knew something was wrong. He knew something should have changed, but he couldn't get himself. He could, no one could, even his wife couldn't make him change, couldn't make him make the decision. So now he's stuck. It's too late. For any of us there, it's too late. You need to make that decision yesterday. You need to not just make a decision, but act on that decision.
Okay, it is never too late to respond to a circumstance as it is. The circumstance has changed as life has moved on. Right, if yesterday was the right time to buy flood insurance, since today the house is 6 feet underwater, then it's too late for that decision, but you do have new choices to make. All right.
There's a big difference, though. Listening to God, listening for God, that season of waiting versus my own deciding not to do something. Like you said, making a choice not to do anything is a choice. I've been told I'm great. I have faith that if God says go, I'll go. Now, there are times where the only person I call or I text is Jim to let him know, if I don't show up at home tonight, this is where I am, come and get me. And there are other times where God will say, I just want you to sit. And I just sit, and I wait, and I get irritated.
Oh, that's hard.
And I don't have the patience for that. But I see God growing that in me, that I would have the ability not just to go, but to also wait. But if God isn't the one who's leading the decision-making process, and it's me, then I've already got a different problem. We were talking earlier with the men's ministry and physical fitness. Not just being on a team, but who is on the team with me. I wrote down two scriptures. One is 1 Timothy 4:8 says, for physical training is of some value, but godliness is value for all things, one promise for both present life and the life to come. And 2 Timothy 3:16 and 17 says that all scripture is God-breathed and is useful for teaching, rebuking, correcting, and training in righteousness, so that the servant of God may be thoroughly equipped for every good work. But if my teammates aren't being equipped by the same book, if they aren't being guided and directed by the same God, we're not on the same team. Sometimes we have to let go of those friendships and those influences that aren't good.
And any psychiatrist will tell you, I know that this is the chosen word here, but expectation brings one thing and one thing only. Because you don't even know what the expectations are. You don't even know what the expectations are. I mean, we can read through the book, but do we ever ask anybody who is more fit than us? Every guy who comes to a football team is given put with somebody. Hey, keep an eye on him. Show him how this works. Show him what we do. Every guy goes in the military and has a paddle on him. Hey, show him how this works. Don't let him shoot himself. Show him how this, where his gear's at. Show him the message. Show him. But oftentimes here, we don't do that. We kind of just let people fly. They come in the front door. They're new. Nobody goes over to school tomorrow. You know what I mean? So the new guy on the team ends up getting traded away. Well, what if we just had an all-star? But nobody off the look. So oftentimes, when you say, we talk about a team, oftentimes I can see the church, this team working against that team, this one working against that one, I'm right, you're wrong, all of these sort of quarreling and infighting. So I think, let's just say the guys in this room right now came together as a team and said, all right, we're going to do this. All going to move in the same direction. This is your job, this is your job, you're an end, you're a center, you're a guard, you're a defender. And we all took our positions. We changed things. But we don't really have somebody who says, look, we're going to look at this. It might be hard. Please write this down. I know you don't want to write the journal. Wait, stop thinking of it like that. Create a book of memoirs. So So when your children are telling their grandchildren to grandchildren about, this is the book that my great-great-grandfather wrote, and there's so much wisdom in here, I can't even tell you.
All right. Let's turn over to Galatians, the fifth chapter. I just want you to look at one simple verse. So you know, we've already gone through what I said are the four types of people that, and you kind of figured out where you fit into that whole thing. Now we're going to look at something tough here. Fifth chapter of Galatians, 13th verse, "You, my brothers, were called to be free, but do not use your freedom to indulge the sinful nature. Rather, serve one another in love. The entire law is summed up in a single command, love your neighbor as yourself. But if you keep on biting and devouring each other, watch out, for you will be destroyed by each other." What is the price of living in freedom? You have a responsibility. There is actually release in living in some form of bondage or slavery. What is that release? Somebody else makes your decisions for you. Somebody else tells you where to go, where to be, what to do at all times. All right, Jim, you said?
Sacrifice. Because what it says here is that you might ravage both yourselves. Why? Because of your desire.
And, okay, sacrifice is a form of responsibility.
So you're going to break down your desires, your want, so that the team can be better.
So I'm going to suggest something here that is probably going to make a few of you very uncomfortable. The price of freedom is responsibility, and sometimes I believe that we use God as the excuse for not making decisions.
I'm going to pray about that. For how long?
Oh, you're adding to that. Okay.
This is the time for prayer. This is the time for action. There's sin in your camp. Get off your knees. But I thought I was supposed to pray. Give me a couple of good words about what you need, and then get off your knees and go do something.
Okay, and that's one example. But what is the purpose of freedom here? What does he say the purpose of freedom is? To serve one another. Remember, one of the marks of spiritual fitness that we said earlier was the ability to recognize an opportunity that sits in front of us and then move into it. But if I'm timid, if I'm not sure, if I think I might make the wrong choice and it might bring bad consequences to me, or not pleasant consequences to me, or something else in my life is going to suffer if I act this way, what am I prone to want to do? I'll wait. And when I wait, have you ever used God as the scapegoat for your inability to act?
Yes. I'll tell you what, next time you want to wait, call somebody. Because we just had it right. We call each other. Hey, I was thinking about doing this. You know what? I'm not going to be around. You ought to wait. We'll do it next time. You know what? Can you handle that for me? I got you back, buddy. That's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That's the team mentality. But when you isolate yourself and keep yourself sort of cooped up and sort of away from people, you don't even have that ability. It's not part of your skill set. It's not even your toolbox. Call somebody. Send around phone lists. Everybody's number here. Everybody else's number. Call once this week. Just once. I would challenge you to call just three people in here this week. Just three. Just to say, hey, think about it. We just texted me yesterday, I think, by the way, you're in. You're on line. You know what I mean? And then, Alan, I feel like I'm on the team. I'm not just, man, nobody called me this week. There's Wednesday, a whole team of people. We say, call people. Mm-hmm. Our thing. Mm-hmm. Call three people this week. And it feels like a team. I can see guys on my team in this week. Four on my team. Okay.
All right, so, big question before we move on. I don't want to leave that verse until we ask ourselves a difficult question. Is there some way in which you could serve or love another human being, and not the safe people, or not the people where somebody's going to see it? Right? We all get, that's why I said that spiritual fitness is not measured by what we do in church or in church circles or when the churchy people are around or any of that. Spiritual fitness is measured by when you serve someone and nobody else notices, nobody else sees it, and you're not worried about it. You just do it because it seems like the right thing to do. And you're not even sure necessarily if it's going to turn out right, but you're just going to do it anyway. Now, remember last week we talked about the consequence of making a good choice? As a matter of fact, we'll back up and we'll just review this choice train. We said that typically we believe that if I make a good choice, I'm going to get a good outcome. If I make a bad choice, I'm going to get a bad outcome, right? Every good choice, remember a few weeks ago we said every good choice is going to open me up to more good choices. Every bad choice is going to in some way or another restrict or limit the future options that I have in front of me. But then last week we said something else. There are many times in life when I'm going to make the right choice, and what's going to happen next?
Bad things are going to come up.
Bad stuff. Bad stuff happens in the short run when we make good choices. We use the example of Joseph because it was the low-hanging fruit. I mean, I really didn't stretch very far to get that one. Joseph with Potiphar's wife, right? It was the right choice. What was the consequence? A wrong experience for Joseph for quite a while. Another one of the reasons why we vacillate in choosing is because we sense that there may be temporary bad consequences for making a good choice. What sane human being wants to inflict pain on themselves for doing the right thing? If this is the price I have to pay to do the right thing, then maybe I'd be just better off doing nothing. Nobody says that, do they? They think it. Because if you say it, it makes you sound bad. But if you think it, you think nobody knows. And they don't. But what if we live that way? Let's turn over to Hebrews, the 10th chapter, the 16th verse. It's not very long, so I'm just going to go ahead and read it. Frankly, if you haven't turned there yet, there's probably no point to it. This is the covenant I will make with them after this time, says the Lord. I will put my laws in their heart, and I will write them on their minds. If that were true for you, what would that make you? If that was a promise that was true, that came from God and was true toward you, what would that make you? It would make you a walking, talking, mobile vessel of God's laws and covenant commitments, and you're carrying that around. And to the degree that that would be true of you, you could step into a new situation and make a choice based on God's guiding principles. And so here's the thing. We've all seen this before, but let's just... So let's let all of life... I'm not very imaginative. I think I used a square last week, but we'll use a square for this week. So let's let that square represent all the possible options that are open to you at this point in time. Some are good, some are bad, some are going to get you into a lot of trouble, some are going to get others into trouble, the whole gamut. All right? Just inside of this somewhere is what we're going to call God's law, God's guiding principles. Now, if we're free, what is God's law to us? If we are free, God's law is to us a protective boundary that maintains our freedom. Nothing more. Can we step over that? Have you stepped over God's law in some way this week? The answer is, of course. If you say no, then you're delusional. The answer is, of course. All right? So, what happens when we step over that boundary? Someone experiences consequences. It's not always us, incidentally. Sometimes we like to make everything in the whole story about us. It's not. Sometimes it's great for us when we make bad choices. It's just really bad for somebody else. Well, let's just be real, right? I have a fight with my wife. I feel better when we leave that transaction, right? Maybe she doesn't. Maybe the kids don't. I feel fantastic. Well, I got that off my mind now. And I move on. Okay, God's guidance. Now, inside of that, as long as we are inside of this inner box, we've got all this freedom to choose. Do you believe that, though? Do you look at God's guiding principles, His laws, as a framework within which you are free to make all kinds of choices and decisions? Now, if that's true, then there's only one other thing that you have to ask. What kinds of choices are right for me? All right, so is the choice that Vinny's going to make about what he's going to do today the right choice for me? And vice versa? No, of course not. Are we both living, ideally speaking, are we both living within the guiding principles of God's law? So, what is the second thing that we need to understand to help us make wise choices? I understand that my choices, if I'm going to live in freedom and continue to live in freedom, need to be within God's guiding principles. What's the next thing that I have to do so that my choices are right for me, Vinny's choices are right for him, and we both honor God with our choices?
Show grace to others.
Keep digging.
Well, I just think my wife likes to do things a certain way, and I'll do the same function differently, and it's not problematic that I'm solving the issue, it's problematic how I'm doing it. So when she shows me grace, I'll still hear that. But I don't look at her and I just laugh. And I don't have to respond to that either. Because I show her grace. I value the relationship more than I do being right.
Okay. Now, see, Vinny identified it. He just doesn't know that he identified it. All right. There are two things that are going to define that. So remember, the first thing is God's framework. The second thing is this. What is the overall purpose for your life? Now, here's how Vinny defined it. Vinny's purpose is, in part, to keep in good relationship with his wife and make her happy. That's not my purpose. I mean, I don't mean to sound cold-hearted about it, but I don't really care if Vinny's wife is happy.
But if you could, just come and do the dishes.
Would that make her happy? Do you see what I'm saying? So in that sense, Vinny has a unique purpose. Part of that purpose is to be able to live in harmony with his wife and his family. That's not my purpose. So as long as you are within God's guiding principles and you are living according to your purpose, you can decide accordingly. Now there's one other thing. That is the unique way that God has fashioned you, that which means the skills, the natural abilities that you have, and also the spiritual gifts that God has poured into you. So if I decide at 5'6" that my life's mission is to play a professional basketball, does that seem reasonable? No, and some people set themselves up for failure like that. Okay, now that was, again, I always pick the lamest, stupidest examples, and I have to apologize for that, but it just makes it real. Do you know God's overall purpose for your life? And or do you know what you believe is God's call on your life? And do you know the unique way that you can express that based on the skills, the talents, the gifts, and the abilities that you have and the opportunities that you have? And let me say in light of opportunities. So if you've got $2 in your pocket and you're struggling to make rent, your life's purpose, at least at this point in your life, is probably not to be one of the world's great philanthropists. Do you understand? Right? So you have to look at the overall context of what is in front of you and say, these are things that would be within God's framework of what I should do. And once you've answered those questions, you know what God's guiding principles are, you know what your mission and your purpose in life is, and you know how God has gifted and called you specifically, then you're well equipped to make a choice. And almost any good choice within that framework is a fine choice. And this is where, I hate to concede this, but this is where, at least in certain situations, Jim is correct, or Jim's dad is correct. Just make a choice. How much pressure do you experience when you don't make a choice?
I
Until you make a choice, you can't manage the choice. All you can manage is the fears, the worries, the anxieties that you have about the choice that you haven't made. Have you ever lived there? Right? And pretty soon, you're so paralyzed that in the end, you don't make any choice. You can manage the choice you've made. You cannot influence the choice you haven't made. Okay, so that brings us to the next thing. I think that many of us live paralyzed lives because we don't want to be trapped. All right, so have you ever made a choice in the past that has taken you to a place where you now feel stuck in your life because you've made a choice in the past? You are stuck in a, and I know this is going to sound harsh, but you feel stuck in a relationship. You feel stuck in a job. You feel stuck in some financial situation. You feel stuck and you hate the stuckness, and the stuckness is really bad, and you don't ever want to be stuck again. Some of you experiencing that, you know what that feels like? Why do you believe that that is abnormal? Why do you believe that people should not ever feel disappointed or stuck or challenged in a situation that they've decided themselves into? Do you know all of the consequences in advance? See, that one of the reasons that we don't choose now is because sometimes the choices we've made us in the past have led us to bad situations and we feel paralyzed and unable to choose. So there's another piece of wisdom. And I'm just going to call this wisdom, and you can decide how wise it is. The man to whom it's attributed is not one that we would say is a spiritual icon, a spiritual pillar. But he said, in all things in life, here's what you need to do. He said, if you want to be successful at something, and we're going to use success in the best of terms here. If you want to be successful at something, decide what you want in life. That's the first principle. Decide what you want. All right, so just so that we're safe here, because I know some people become immediately uncomfortable when I say decide what you want, what would be some good overarching decisions about life that you would feel comfortable saying, this is what I want? Give me a couple examples. Make them safe examples. See, you thought it was easy to pick low-hanging fruit, didn't you? It's not. Bill?
To be involved in other people's lives.
Okay, that's a good, this is what I want.
I want to raise my children in the fear and admonition of the Lord.
Okay, that's what I want. Anybody else? All right. Decide the price that you are willing to pay to achieve that success. That's the second component. Decide the price that you're willing to pay to achieve that success. Now, Bill said something, Paul said something. What are some of the prices that we might have to pay in order to do that?
You may have to start from scratch. So, give an example. During my testimony and during some talks I talked about some of my financial stuff.
Talk to them. I have to go get coffee because Jason just doesn't love me anymore.
Financial messaging on yourself is bad. And sometimes what you have to do is, after God has told you, you have to find someone who has a question and say, I'm stuck. I need your help so I can get unstuck. And that means you have to start from scratch. That means you have to do things that are going to be uncomfortable. So, for example, for me, I had to see what it was like to put a budget together. I had to track my spending every single day. So, if I went to the vending machine and I still do it, I have to be like, then I have to give that to him at the end of the month, and he's going to be like, dude, you wasted $20 on the vending machine. But at the same time, you have to figure out what that long-term goal is going to be. Because you can say, man, this is tough, and give up 2 months from now. Or you can say, look, 2 years from now, I can be out of debt, or 6 months from now, I can pay out $3,000 worth of debt. It just means you have to humble yourself, start from scratch, and work your way to the top.
Okay. Let's take a look at Paul's example. So Paul said,
raising your children in the fear and admonition of the Lord.
Okay. What does that look like? What is that going to ask of me?
A lot of time.
Okay, it's going to ask time. Remember one of the things that we said when we went through one of the parenting series? We said one of the greatest challenges that a parent has when he disciplines a child is that very often the discipline is going to ask more of the child or the parent than it does of the child. Right? If I'm going to say, you're grounded, let's say, that's an easy example. If I'm going to say, you're grounded, who's going to stay home and enforce that? Uh-oh, now I'm in the house. I had other plans for the day. But now if I'm going to ground you, that means I got to stay home. Right, that, again, that's an easy example. But can you see how Paul's commitment, this big goal that he has, is going to ask something from him? It's actually going to ask a lot from him.
Very well. Having lived through it, and the biggest thing is a change in your life, because once they get past 4 or 5 years old, they start to lead or pick up your example. And I remember, did that kind of happened just as I came to Christ, as my kids were 5, 3, and 4, 2, and unborn yet, or just born. And I remember going back to where I went to college, to a homecoming and everything like that, and, you know, starting to reminisce to my wife about what, you know, happened in my fraternity house. Bad example, Paul, you know, got ears here, you know, and it was the whole process of her, you know, the next 20 years. That, I have to tell you, that's a big order for you guys that have young kids to raise your children with fear and admonition. It's a constant process that's going to go on for many, many years. So it's a good goal to try.
But in order to do that, it may ask things of you financially. It may ask things of you relationally. It may impinge on some of your other freedoms. Now, who hasn't lived through, I made this decision, I want this, but now I'm experiencing the price that I said I was willing to pay, but I didn't understand what it felt like to pay that price. That was just some words on a piece of paper, and now I'm paying the price. It doesn't feel anything at all like what I expected it would. Which leads us to the final thing. Decide what you won't do. What you won't give up. Those are the three things. Decide what you want. Decide the price that you're willing to pay. Decide what things you will not compromise or will not do in order to achieve the goal. Now, let's move beyond that. Suppose you get... See, and if this is really worthwhile, this is going to take a while. Right, this is not just, well, I've decided I want a new car. All right, that we can make happen pretty quickly. It's done and it's over with. The pain of paying for it might take years, but we can at least make that happen. But what about Paul's commitment to raise up what we're going to call spiritually fit children who honor God in their day-to-day lives? That's a 18, 20-year process. Oh, no, wait. There's more than one. All right, that extends the process. It's not like I can have just one and when I'm done with that one. There's multiples. And I didn't have them all on the same day, so it's going to spread out over maybe 30 years of life. And it's still not done because they're still going to be thinking about and looking at dad and mom because they're entering seasons of life now where as adults they're making choices and they're going to see if the choices that dad and mom have made are still playing out well. So it becomes actually a lifelong commitment, I believe.
There's grandchildren now. You've got to tone it down to the 5-year-old grandkid. You know, because he's starting to pick up your grandpa with us.
There you go. This is depressingly long. It just never seems to end.
Yeah, I thought it was done at 21. You know?
Now.
We teach our kids what matters. My kids know the name of all the homeless people in town and aren't afraid to go in and give them hugs. And they say and they do things differently than their friends do. But they'll say, last week I got to preach at one of the churches we're going to. And that night my little girl said, Daddy, I'm proud of you. I don't know had we not said to her that we're proud of her and then explained why, she wouldn't say things like that to us. That is the first time she's 12 years old to tell me she's proud of me. All right, man. I was like 35 before I heard my dad ever say he was proud of me. I don't know that I've ever said to my dad, I'm proud of you. But the way that we live, the example that we set, sets the tone for generations. If I'm willing to succumb to the pressures of the world and to be what the world says versus believing what the Bible says, then I should have no expectation that it's going to continue on.
All right. So we're going to take what Paul said, because it was a reasonably, it was a good goal. It was a good goal. It was a typical goal. But I'm going to push on it a little bit, and I'm going to say, is it enough? Remember what we said, that one of the measures of a spiritually fit man is that he recognizes good opportunities. Right? Good opportunities that are in front of him. And we said that the measure of freedom, that the purpose for freedom is what? Already said that. We looked at it. What does Paul say in Galatians? The purpose for our freedom is to serve one another, right? In some way. So, is it enough to develop a cycle where I raise... Are you laughing at me because the cheap marker ran out of ink? Really? So, I raise... Here's generation one. I raise good kids. All right? Who in turn raise good kids? Who in turn raise good kids? Is that a good goal? You bet it is. Is that enough? See, because if we're going to do something worthwhile in lives, I have to, while I am raising good kids, be doing good work myself. Because if I raise good kids without doing good work myself, actually, what do my kids see? They see nothing. They don't see that up here. And so what do my kids live toward? The next generation, and the next generation, and the next generation. And incidentally, while there's nothing wrong with it, we see generation after generation in this country where their goal is, as a matter of fact, it's become part of the American dream. What is the American dream? That my kids will have a better life than I do. Tell me we haven't all heard that. Is it a bad goal? No. Is it a complete goal? Probably not. See, if it was a really functional, complete goal, would our country be experiencing the level of conflict and turmoil that it is right now? Probably not. One of the reasons we're experiencing some of the conflict and the turmoil, not all of it, life changes, the world changes, situations change, but we have become so internally focused that we just live from generation to generation to generation to improve the lives of our children. We have to also be focused on doing some good work ourselves.
I like that verse. It's Psalm 127:4. Like arrows in the hands of a warrior, the children born of one's youth. Blessed is a man whose quiver is full of them. And I've heard this say that verse, you know, as far as raising your children, is not just really your children before them, but the generations that come here that you're launching those children and generations into the future to make a difference for Christ. And that's kind of been my theme, you know, as I grew spiritual maturity as I got later in life here, as, you know, my kids kind of say, you know, like, this is the big picture. This isn't just really for these kids here. I want to see what my, because we were first generation Christians, and I wanted to see what, I want to know from eternity standpoint what my grandchildren and great grandchildren.
Back of the page that you're using right now, there's a little note there that says use the bridge photos. I don't have the bridge photos, but we're going to get back to that. So that's a note to me, not to you. All right, let's read what's below that. Small goals striven for will almost always ensure small, safe, and predictable outcomes. Big goals striven for, well, what? Okay, so let's stop. Look up from the paper. So if I set a small goal, and that makes it possible for me to achieve a small outcome, what do you suppose is the result of setting a big goal? You mean I didn't trap anybody in that? Really? What do you suppose is the outcome of setting a big goal?
Hopefully it's a big result.
It is. Hope there. We finally got somebody who has at least walked into the have a heart trap. He can still walk back out. Hopefully, yes, that's what it is, right? When we set a big goal, we hope we're going to achieve a big outcome. But what if we don't? And this is why many of us play it safe. It's easier to set a small goal that I can achieve than to set a large goal that I might fail at. But if I set a large goal that is a worthy goal, it makes more of me and it creates a foundation on which the next generation can continue to build. A big goal will do more to change you than it may to change life. And this is a principle that we're going to look at in more detail in future weeks. But God has more at stake than just stuff getting done. It's not, oh, I want to do God's will. Remember what we said with that diagram already. There's a gazillion things within God's general will for your life. There's half a gazillion that still fit within your giftings and your talents and your purpose. There's a third of a gazillion that fit all them together. There's plenty of opportunity that's within God's will. It's not that you need to spend forever seeking God's will. It's, do you have the courage to set something big? And there's a photo that I love that's part of a video. Have you ever seen the YouTube videos of that Norwegian highway that goes along the Atlantic coast? You know what I'm talking about. You should go home and YouTube it. Write this down. Seriously, you should go look at this bridge. It is phenomenal. There are two bridges I want you to look at. The one is a bridge that we're going to talk about that spans a chasm in France. The other one is a bridge that runs along the Norwegian highway. It's the Atlantic coast of Norway. They're phenomenal engineering feats, but we're going to talk about the one in France. And I know you're thinking, what does this have to do with spiritual growth? But it really matters. So about 40 or 50 years ago in France, they realized that they had this major problem. How many of you have lived most of your lives right around here? Okay. Do you remember the time when the Pennsylvania Turnpike north of us had only a single hole punched through the Lehigh Mountain? Right, and when on a weekend you were either coming home from the Poconos on a Sunday or going to the Poconos on a Friday, what happened? There was a real backup, right? And so ultimately somebody had the dream, the idea, we need to punch another hole in the mountain because we need to make more room for traffic. All right, so we're going to move that same basic idea. We're going to move it into France. There is the inland part of France, there's a major coastal area where there's tourist opportunity, and every year during the vacation season, there were towns in this valley in France that were just inundated with traffic. So they wanted to solve the problem by doing something to facilitate better traffic flow. Well, here's the problem. There's this deep chasm that they've got to cross, and they don't know what to do about it. And not only that, but the valley itself is absolutely stunningly beautiful. And they made a commitment. Decide what you will not give up. They made a commitment to retain the aesthetic and natural beauty of the area. In other words, no transportation solution was going to compromise the natural beauty of the area. And because they made that commitment, it took them forever to decide what they were going to do. Finally, between an architect and an engineer, they came up with an aesthetically pleasing design for a bridge that they believed it was possible to build. Today, that bridge is the tallest bridge in the world. It's a cable stay bridge. I don't know if that means anything to you. That's one of those ones where there's all the cables that go down from central spires that go up. So it is literally today the tallest cable stay bridge in the world. They had to create the structures necessary and the systems necessary to build the bridge. In other words, they didn't use current engineering to serve a current problem. They had to develop the processes, the construction processes needed to build the bridge before they could actually build the bridge. And as the bridge rose up, they encountered more problems and therefore had to develop new and improved systems of construction to solve the problems that they encountered as they went along. Now, I want you to think about this. Suppose that they had settled for a small road through the valley. What would they have learned? What would have happened? Nothing. A small and ordinary goal produces a small and ordinary result. Now, I want you to think about this in all of your life. If you set a small goal, you're almost guaranteed to hit it. You're almost guaranteed to go through your life and live a relatively carefree, trouble-free life. So here's the question. Is that the life that you want to live? Would you be willing to risk a whole lot more in the hopes of achieving something great, knowing that in the middle... And I watched a documentary on the construction of this bridge, and I'm telling you, just watching it on television from the comfort of my chair, my heart was up about, say, here a few times when I was looking at some of the aerial shots of the guys hanging on stuff, working on these concrete spires that were going up. Every human being that worked on that bridge was stretched to the limits of his ability. Are you and I willing to be stretched to the limits of our ability and beyond by the choices that we make to do something good or something great? And that's that sticky question is the one that I would actually like to leave you with. Now let's turn over to the end of the book of Joshua. I'm going to wrap up with one final thing. So we'll turn over to the 24th chapter. I'm faced with this dilemma where I feel like I need to read the whole chapter, but we don't have time to read the whole chapter. So I guess I'm going to have to paraphrase it. So we'll go to the 24th chapter. We'll start at the beginning. Then Joshua assembled all the tribes of Israel at Shechem, and he summoned the elders, the leaders, the judges, the officials of Israel, and they presented themselves before God. So Shechem would have served as the unofficial first capital of that region for them. It's a valley area between two mountains, and they met there, and it had some spiritual significance, it had some political significance. It was an area that they were finally in control of by the time of the end of Joshua's life. Joshua's an old man at this time, and he's gathered all the people together. And Joshua said to the people, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Long ago your forefathers, including Terah, the father of Abraham, and Nahor, lived beyond the river and worshipped other gods. But I took your father Abram from the land beyond the river and led him through Canaan and gave him many descendants, and I gave him Isaac. And to Isaac I gave Jacob and Esau. And I assigned the hill country of Seir to Esau, but Jacob and his sons went down to Egypt." Okay, so we're going to push pause right there. For a moment, I'd like you to imagine that you were Abram. And you could live to see this day. Remember all the life of Abram and the difficulties and the promise that never seems to happen and the promise that never seems to be fulfilled and all the missteps and all the frustration and leave here, go there, do this, famine, problems, wives that won't get pregnant, kids that don't seem to materialize, all this stuff. What's Abram thinking on a day-to-day basis? Let's not over-spiritualize this, and let's not take two sentences of Scripture where Abram was a man of faith. Do you suppose that in 40 or 50 years of adult life, Abram had some doubts? Do you have doubts? Do you feel God has a call in your life? Do you still have doubts? Then don't suppose that Abram had no doubts. Suppose that you could be Abram and live to see this day. And look at how much history is just summed up here. Let's read it again. This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Long ago your forefathers, including Terah, the father of Abram and Nahor, lived beyond the river and worshipped other gods. But I took your father Abram from the land beyond the river and led him through Canaan and gave him many descendants. You realize we're talking till we get to the point where Joshua's standing there. We're talking about something like 500 to 600 years. And yet he's looking back and saying, if it were not for the pilgrimage, the journey that Abram started, we would not be standing on this land today having this conversation. Now that's a pretty amazing thing. This journey started hundreds and hundreds of years ago, and no one person in all those hundreds of years had a full picture of what was going to happen. They saw only their little piece of the puzzle. And in most cases, the piece of the puzzle that they got to see and to live in was pretty freaking challenging. It was no walk in the park. It was, for the most part, very difficult, and for the most part, filled with questions and confusion and doubt, and where in the world is God in all this mess? From Abram thinking to himself, geez, when am I ever going to have a kid? This is impossible. To people stuck in slavery for hundreds of years thinking, well, if there's a God, he sure doesn't seem like he cares about us. To facing down the Egyptians, to crossing the Jordan River, to battling with all these people to get to this place. If there's a God, I wonder where he is. We're just going to have to take this a day at a time and hope that God shows up. And like Jim said, I guess we'll put a few rocks in the ground here and there, there's memorials to remind us that God has showed up in the past. Because right now, that's the only thing we have to cling to. God has showed up in the past. Boy, I sure hope he shows up today. All right, I don't have time to go through the rest of this, so what I'd like us to do is go to the very end, to chapter 28. So Joshua recounts for them this long history of where they came from, where they have been, what they have been through, what God has taken them through, and where they are at this moment in time. And then he introduces them to this. You have a choice. You have a choice to continue to live out this journey, to continue to push back the boundaries, and the next thing for them was to completely settle the land, to bring a good situation about for their people, and to be a role model for surrounding kingdoms. They had a choice. They could continue to do that, or they could, at this point in time, say, we've made it. Now we can coast. Have you ever felt that? I've made it. Now I can kind of coast. Why would I ever put at risk the good that I already have in the pursuit of the great that I might never achieve? Let me repeat that again. Why would I ever put at risk the good that I already have in pursuit of the great that I might never achieve? And that's the story right here. 28. Then Joshua sent the people away, each to his own inheritance. And after these things, Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110. And they buried him in the land of his inheritance, at Timnath, in the hill country of Ephraim, north of Mount Gaash. Israel served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Joshua and the elders who outlived him and who had experienced everything that the Lord had done for Israel. Is there someone whose leadership you have counted on throughout your life and they're now gone? Is there someone who made big choices for you and now they're gone? Someone whose wisdom you could count on and now they're gone? Because what's happened here is the people who used to make the decisions, the people that everybody looked up to and said, well, if we don't know what to do, we'll just go to them because they seem to be in touch with God and they know what, they'll figure it out for us. What happens when all the people who figure it out for us are gone and we're the only people that are left? And Joseph's bones, which the Israelites had brought up from Egypt, were buried at Shechem, in the tract of land that Jacob brought for 100 pieces of silver. So there's the next thing. Jacob, hundreds of years before, buys a parcel of land. Joseph, the leader who saved them all from starvation, in a human sense, his bones are finally brought back and placed in the place of his forefathers who provided the land for him. In other words, that whole cycle is now done and closed. And here's the last piece of it. And Eleazar, the son of Aaron, died and buried at Gibeah. The son of Aaron. Remember who Aaron was? Moses' companion. The two of them together take the people out of Israel. The two of them together take this whole journey. His son, who could remember that? He's gone. In other words, everybody who took us to this place, to this spot of real estate that we are standing on between two mountains right now, Everybody that took us to this place is now gone. You know the book ends like that? That's it. And there's silence in the country. And in the middle of that silence, there's this overarching question. What are you going to do with what's been given to you? And that's it. And it says they all go home to their own homes, their own parcels of land. They all go home to their own lives with this one big question. What are we all going to do next? I think that's a huge question for all of us to ask. I'm done.